This is the Infotagem podcast, the vaccine to the disinformation virus. 6th of January 2021 will be remembered as the day the insurrection incited online by Donald Trump against the result of the presidential election last November took over the congressional buildings on Capitol Hill in Washington and led to the death of five people. Social media disinformation, some of it from the president himself, has stoked these tensions to fever pitch over the last few months, but the problem goes back years. What will be the long-term impact of so much poison being pumped into the political system in America? I'm Damien Collins, and in this podcast, we'll be discussing these issues with Clint Watts, Senior Fellow at the Center for Cyber and Homeland Security at George Washington University, and the author of the book, Messing with the Enemy, Surviving in a Social Media World of Hackers, Terrorists, Russians and Fake News. He previously served as a US Army infantry officer, an FBI special agent, and the executive officer of the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point. But first, we'll hear from our regular guest, the disinformation analyst Charles Creel.
Well, Charles, it's been a huge amount going on in the last week or two. So a huge amount for you to pick from for today's podcast. But what in particular do you want to focus on today?
Well, it's been a little hard to choose this week, Damien, but there has been a little trouble in Washington this week. It seems the president of the United States incited a crowd to insurrection. Nobody was really surprised by that. But what's surprising is how the social media websites, Trump's channel to the public, have reacted. Trump has been dumped from the internet. Just a few days ago, the biggest names in tech removed Trump and much of his operation from their platforms. Even Facebook dumped Trump. It started a while back in November, y'all will remember, when Twitter started flagging Trump's tweets, claiming he'd won the election and that it had been stolen from him. They added text to his tweets like, quote, "This claim about election fraud is disputed." But last week, Twitter locked Trump's account for half a day, insisting he delete three offending tweets. Then a couple of days and a couple more offending tweets later, they banned his account outright, along with @POTUS and @TeamTrump. Now, Facebook was uncharacteristically fast off the mark this time. They outright banned Trump from both Facebook and Instagram the same day that Twitter only issued a warning. YouTube removed several Trump account videos that they claim violated their terms of services. Snapchat banned Trump's account. Reddit removed the subreddit channels The Donald and Donald Trump, the latter of which was a big watering hole for the Stop the Steal conspiracy theorists. And even Twitch also disabled Trump's channel the day after the riots. But here's one that I found really interesting and a real surprise. Very few people saw this coming. Salesforce announced that they had taken action against the Republican National Committee after the RNC blasted out a post-insurrection email campaign for Republicans to, quote, "step up right now and defend the integrity of this election." Now, they said the action would prevent the RNC from sending emails that would incite violence, but they didn't say exactly how. What is clear, and this is according to Vice, is that the RNC uses Salesforce tool called Exact Target for their email campaigns, and that makes this a devastating blow to the party in terms of communications and in terms of fundraising. Now, what does this all mean, though? It means, first, it's one hell of a lot harder for Republicans, and Trump in particular, to reach the public. And yes, they have Fox, but even Fox has to survive the Trump administration. And with Parler now shut down as well, the Trump operation, they have moved to a completely new platform. And I'm not going to say what it is because I don't want to promote it. But we should all be on the lookout for it. It's something you've probably never heard of. Is the Dump Trump movement important? Well, absolutely. First, Trump has already started making public claims that the insurrection was the work of Antifa, the political polar opposite of the MAGA crowd that marched on DC. But more important, if things go as armed MAGA insurgents are planning, we haven't seen the end of the violence. Capitol Hill police just briefed Democrats on further organized violence, and this included a plot to encircle the U.S. Capitol and assassinate Democrats and some Republicans in what's being billed as, quote, "the largest armed protest ever to take place on American soil." And I don't laugh because it's funny. I laugh because it is so unbelievable. These are really strange days. But finally, all of this is really important that the tech giants are banning content and and channels, because what it says about them is that they have editorial practices and that they bear responsibility for the content that's spread through their platforms. And now it's the opportunity, a great opportunity for legislators to really step up, Damien.
Absolutely right, Charles. And we've been talking a lot about that on the podcast. But previously, we've often, well, I anyway, have cited that I thought YouTube has moved quicker than Facebook in dealing with some of these issues around, for example, that they acted faster against the Nancy Pelosi deepfake film. But not here. It's quite interesting that YouTube are maintaining a three strikes and you're out policy, and therefore it seems you can plan three insurrections before you get kicked off YouTube, and YouTube is still showing Donald Trump's channel.
It's astonishing. And when Facebook announced the outright ban, I was really surprised by it. It felt as though Facebook were somehow in Trump's pocket for such a very long time. And to see this move is really, really surprising.
And I remember before the election, when you were in Alabama, you were saying that people were buying up guns and ammo in the local stores. Are you concerned that we could see a wave of violence across the country?
I think we can see that. So there are starting to be reports coming out. The FBI has done some briefing that this anticipated wave of protests at all of 50 state capitals across the country may actually be about to happen. There are a lot of caveats on that. That's if Trump is removed from office and so on. But even that it's being discussed is just extraordinary. And it's good to remember, too, and I'm not sure if I made it clear, but this Capitol Hill police briefing about encircling the Capitol and assassinating Democrats and some Republicans, that's a new briefing after the insurgency.
And Clint Watts, I mean, it's fantastic to have you with us here on the podcast in these extraordinary times. I remember Charles and I both met you along with the rest of the Digital Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee in New York nearly 3 years ago. It was February 2018 to see a presentation you gave about the lessons you'd learned analyzing disinformation really as a weapon in the Middle East in particular, and in particular as practiced by the Russians and the Iranians. Here we are 3 years on, looking at these extraordinary scenes in America. Do you think we are now sort of bearing the fruit of a number of years worth of active disinformation and conspiracy theory campaigns directed at the American people?
Yes, and thanks for having me on the show. You know, what's interesting to me is that there was a point probably around when I met you, Damien, that I was having discussions with people in D.C., and immediately the worry became that if we don't have proper legislation or rules around the behavior of politicians with this stuff, they would immediately adopt the playbook the Russians were using for their own personal gain. And I had a conversation not far from the Capitol about this with somebody, and that's exactly what happened. And there was a question I was asked when I testified to the Senate Intel Committee, and it was like, why did Russian active measures work? And my response was, well, Donald Trump was doing a version of that as well. He was doing a version of active measures. He was using disinformation. He was using widespread social media propaganda. And so he doesn't have to act in concert with the Russians, but they work in parallel and yet are supportive of each other, in the sense that they destroy the information ecosystem to where it's difficult to know what is true. And it allows people to choose their preferred reality over actual reality. And I think that's really the culmination of what we saw last Wednesday at the Capitol, was what happens after 4 years of that, meaning that people begin to believe, after being bombarded with such a wide and persistent array of propaganda and disinformation, that the election was stolen because President Trump said so. Then when you see the president go out in a crowd and urge them to go to the Capitol, then this is what the result of that is. They will pursue this to the very end. And it's remarkable, I think, in several ways, as Charles was saying, with the tech companies waiting so long, to where now it's too late, really, right? This wave has built up on their platforms for an enormous amount of time. They could see it. They know what the algorithms are producing. And just now they're starting to make those hard decisions that had they made those decisions a couple of years ago, could have muted some of the the very on the ground, real world physical effects that we're feeling in the United States today.
Are you concerned that the system has been pumped so full of poison over that period of time that this is just not going to go away, that the what we saw in the Capitol on the 6th of January is maybe the first manifestation of the consequences of this sort of information warfare that has been waged on the American people?
I do. There's no real going back. And I think what you see is the way conservatives that support Trump, they're not even conservatives, the way Trump supporters support Trump, they will seek out, and if they cannot find it, build an alternative information ecosystem. Parler was a version of that to a degree, right? It was mostly for Trump supporting people. That's what it was there for. And domestic extremist groups were there. We even detected foreign, you know, influence in a platform like that, because that's who they want to rile up. So they're going to move. And we've been through this before. During the war on terror, we had the, you know, usurping of platforms by ISIS, and before them Al-Qaeda. And it got out of control. And what happened? Well, they were purged from a lot of these platforms. What did they do? Well, they had reached a sizable number of supporters that they could regenerate and build alternative networks by which to communicate. They're not as strong even today as they were when they were on Facebook and Twitter and the mainstream platforms, but they have a way to still organize and coalesce together. And I think that's what we should expect to see as we see these movements deplatform from mainstream social media, purge from a lot of the media spaces, that they will regenerate. And they are sizable. They're much larger in size than ISIS or Al-Qaeda or any of these, you know, international terrorist groups were. They're big enough in size that they actually will be able to put themselves together in a way that they can organize, collaborate, and coordinate.
I think if you take several million people and they can create a network for themselves pretty effectively out of that. But given your experience in the intelligence community, I'm interested to know what you think about the speed with which the companies have acted, not just companies like Facebook and Twitter in blocking content, to, you know, closing accounts, but I was particularly interested in the way that Amazon and Google effectively turned off Parler. Do you think there is concern of a concerted effort using those services that could lead to some new protest demonstration or some other atrocity being committed, and therefore there may well have been a conversation between the tech companies and the intelligence community about the need to act very swiftly?
Absolutely. We've seen threats online already with my research team that are specifically talking about attacking a big tech location or attacking a place like Amazon, you know, on their servers. We picked up on some of that last night. So I definitely think there's a high risk of that. I think the good news is those places are, you know, fairly well defended, but it's not quite clear how they would execute an attack. Still to this day, I would remind people that on Christmas Day here in the United States, we're still trying to determine if a large bombing that happened in Nashville, Tennessee was connected to worries about technology. I don't think it's really been fleshed out by the FBI yet. But that momentum was already there with respect to 5G, big tech. I assume that there's going to be high risk for them throughout the rest of this year.
Do you think that with the inauguration soon upon us, we're recording this show on the 12th of January, so in 8 days' time, the inauguration, Joe Biden will take place. Do you think there will be a relaxation amongst the intelligence community in particular, in the sense that they feel that people can now start to talk about these issues again, government resources can be directed towards investigating them, because that, in a way that's been just too difficult with Donald Trump in the White House?
Yes, and this could be sensed with any colleague that I talked to over the last year, where they were trying to defend against election interference while also trying not to be fired. You know, it was competing demands. You couldn't really talk about Russian interference or deal with it. You couldn't have a press conference. Even just yesterday, the Treasury Department actually did an OFAC designation against Andrei Dukach's associates. So they're still pursuing a lot of that. I expect all of that to pick up quickly, you know, by summertime even. I think there will be discussions about it. But again, I return to the legislators, and particularly when I've been to Congress, is that they have not been able to gain a consensus about what they want the institutions to do in terms of free speech with the tech companies, what they want policed with regard to extremism, or how they want federal and state and local law enforcement to pursue domestic extremists. I've testified, I think, 5 times since Trump took office. And every time I go there, there are recommendations put forward. One side of the political spectrum will kind of shout at the big tech companies. The other side will shout about censorship. I think the tech companies, what you are seeing this week is reflective of one thing above all others, and it's not the insurrection at the Capitol. It's that two Georgia senators were elected last week, which kind of got lost in the news cycle. But that changed the balance in terms of the Senate. And I think what you're seeing with the tech companies is they know additional scrutiny is coming, and they're trying to show good faith that they're trying to address these issues before they're called to testify.
Something we talk about quite a lot on this show about the role for regulation, and in particular in Europe, both the UK and in the European Union, there are now sort of proposals out there for how a system of social media regulation would work. The UK online harms proposals, it is, would create a schedule of content that companies would be liable for. And it seems that there is a now quite a strong move around the world to establish the principle of the social media companies having some sort of legal liability to act against harmful content, including content that's not criminal. And in America, it would seem the debate suggests that the companies do have a liability, even if people don't agree what that liability should be. But we see the Democrats feel that the companies don't do enough to remove harmful content, and some conservatives think they do too much. But it seems that we're moving to a place where there's a growing consensus that these decisions on what content should be removed, what should be allowed to stay, shouldn't just be left to people like Mark Zuckerberg. And also, and I think particularly after the response to the events on the Capitol Hill, it's almost impossible now to say that the tech companies don't in some ways edit and curate the content on their platforms. They're not just the neutrally serving content created by the people.
I think that's exactly right. And I've worked with the tech companies, you know, at times to help them. And what I've found is that while I think they will fuss and fight, you know, and try and keep as much content up as possible, because it's a cost, right? You're taking on cost if you're doing policing, you're taking on risk. But as soon as they find out what they are to be policing, they tend to do it, right? Because they're worried about fines and they're worried about regulation. So I really feel like Europe has led the way on this issue. And when I've interacted with the tech companies, it's very clear that they just are basing their policies to a degree already looking forward based on what the European regulatory environment is. They are preparing that whatever Europe is doing will be first and most others will follow. And so it's been interesting to watch them. What I find still confusing is why they don't act in unison together the way they have over the last week around common parameters, if that makes sense. So as you guys were talking about the intro, you were talking about YouTube's three strikes policy versus Twitter's, you know, review after the fact. They each have sort of a different system to do the same thing. And so for 3 or 4 years now, I've advocated to them. I just haven't understood it, why they wouldn't develop a form of a information security alliance or a coordinating council, right? Where they could build collectively together. They are not competing with each other on content. It's much like the banks don't compete on cybersecurity with malware, right? Like everyone loses if the ecosystem is soiled. And they would be stronger and probably make better decisions collectively about content moderation if they work together. They could also help the smaller companies. So there's examples of places like Reddit, which are amazing platforms, but have very few employees and don't generate that much revenue compared to like a Facebook. So if they had a governing council, they work together as an industry and as an association, They could evenly moderate content across all platforms. It would keep this sort of whack-a-mole from occurring, where people run from one platform to the next in the extremism space or election interference, whatever it might be. They could share signals and triage. They could interact with governments and regulatory regimes in a more even way, much like finance or manufacturing or other industries do. For some reason, they still think that they're competing with each other, even when they're really not. You know, separate on the antitrust stuff, I think it really just comes down to like, okay, you're not really competing. You're all losing. You're all getting called to testify at the same time. Why not work together and bring in outside parties that are respected, journalists, former legislators, former tech executives, you know, to help be sort of a governing board to help you navigate through this very complicated issue. I'm still confused why they have not made that maneuver.
I think that's a really good point. And I certainly think if around the world, the principle in law becomes established that they have liabilities, they have responsibilities and liabilities for the way in which they run their platforms. And we move on from the debate around whether they're just like the wires in the telephone network. You know, they connect people who speak to each other, but they don't do the speaking. Once we get beyond that and the companies get beyond that, whether they will look at this differently would be interesting to know. And one of the issues we've talked about on this show before is that if you look at financial services, we have certain standards of practice that we expect companies that are headquartered in Europe or in North America to follow around the world. So in the UK, the Bribery Act covers any transactions involving a British national, a British company anywhere in the world. America has in many ways even far further reaching powers for its authorities. If we had some consensus from the tech companies on global standards, it would be good to see those applied in other parts of the world as well, even parts of the world which haven't legislated domestically or may never do, to make sure those standards are met, to say that, you know, you can't allow your systems to be used to do something which would be illegal at home.
That's right. And it seems like some of these solutions in the collective are staring us in the face, you know, to a degree. And yet they won't do it. And for some reason, when you go to Silicon Valley or you meet with them, you have essentially the equivalent of InfoSec, right? The trust and safety people of all of these platforms in the same rooms all the time. In fact, the revolving door of the Democrats now has been, you know, for Republicans in the US, they all go into the defense industry a lot of times, right? For the Democrats, they all go out to Silicon Valley. And when I go there, you'll see representatives of many different companies that are all from the same office inside the US government just 2 years before. And so you would think they have government experience, they have regulatory experience. You would think they would more quickly move to work together in an overt way to get these things done. But it just has not happened. And I don't know if that's maybe at the highest level, you know, leadership, if that's at the Zuckerberg, Jack, you know, sort of level, or why that doesn't happen. But it seems pretty obvious to me. And I think in terms of this rivalry, this sort of contentious relationship between Brussels, DC, and, you know, the tech companies, and then all these other authoritarians that are really aligning up against democracies, this would be beneficial to everybody to work together in this capacity. And maybe that'll happen, you know, more going forward.
I think I agree with you. It's certainly been their interest to do that. And just thinking about the debate over the last few years, because people often say to me, well, you know, since Cambridge Analytica, has anything really changed? And I think some things have changed. And I think 2-3 years ago, when we talked about Russian interference in the West and the Russians weaponizing social media, I think some people, you know, understood that and could see what was going on. I think there were other people who thought, well, if it's going on, it's probably very only going on in a very small way, and you know, I as an individual would not be influenced by something the Russians targeted me on Facebook. And I think now, though, people look at what's happened, particularly in 2020 and the start of this year, and have seen the rise of conspiracy networks like QAnon, see events as they unraveled in Washington in January, and the way in which people took to the streets, motivated by, again, largely lies and conspiracy theories spread, starting with the president on social media after the election. And they look at the rise of anti-vaccine conspiracy theories and conspiracy theories around COVID. I think people now have got a much clearer picture of just how much damage can be done through disinformation networks weaponizing social media.
It is pervasive in everything that we're doing right now. So before the whole Capitol raid, you know, that happened last week, my number one concern was vaccine disinformation in 2021. That was essentially, I think it is still and will be one of the bigger concerns for the West outside of election interference. A second one is really come down to 5G technology and technology disinfo, which it absolutely has its roots with the Russians, who really were forerunners in that disinformation. And so these things are clear harms now to society. It is not just eroding trust in officials, it's slowing us down from overcoming the pandemic. It's slowing us down from developing our technology infrastructure, which we are more reliant on than ever with the pandemic. I have advocated, and I did on a panel just last week, we need to define these harms, and we can do it. I think one of the advantages, unfortunate, but still an advantage of COVID-19 and 5G, as you said, Damian, is that we can measure these harms now. For example, how many incidences do we have of towers being burned down or damaged, or line workers being confronted with conspiracies around 5G? We can measure this. We would do this in a terrorism context and say, okay, here's suspicious activity reports. So we can now measure, we know what the conspiracies are in terms of quantity and quality online in the social media space. We know who's consuming them. We know who's proliferating them. And now we can see a physical manifestation of that. We're to that point where we can clearly define harms. And I think with defining harms, you can better regulate the disinformation, the propaganda, the conspiracies that are out there on social media.
I mean, from the way you describe it there, it would seem to me that it is well within the reach of the technology companies to be more effective at doing this, because when we're looking at disinformation networks operating at scale, then there are patterns that the trained eye can easily detect, and certainly that their technological tools could be trained to detect and spot earlier than they sometimes do.
For sure. Yeah, I think part of it is linking the two together. So if you look at the very slow and frustrating process that we went through in the war on terror, is that we did get to a point where we could tell, we could have government designate and quantify what a threat is to the UK or the US. We got to a point where they could communicate that to the social media companies. Social media companies, once they know what to look for, are very good, really, really good at, taking things down. But their problem is they have the whole world, on scale on their platform. So they don't necessarily understand the context. They thought their algorithms would just sort of figure it out. So we've gotten there in terrorism, which is a model for how we could get there much more quickly now. What I would like to see governments doing more is, one, aside from regulation, telling tech companies what they want taken down, is two, can you help quantify harms, specifically so that we understand what's going on? The Department of Homeland Security in the US, and I guess it would be kind of the Home Office in the UK, are they capturing right now threats to vaccine distribution points? Are they capturing threats to 5G technology and infrastructure? Those things are critical, because that is actually how we establish harms. That's how we build thresholds for when we should be policing speech. That's the difference between free speech and yelling fire, in a movie theater. And those things, I think, can be put together now. But it takes that cooperation. And maybe we'll move more towards that here in a couple of weeks.
So for that, as part of defining what harmful content would be, it sounds like you're saying within that you could have a situation whereby if a tech company was warned that there was likely to be a threat to certain pieces of infrastructure because of a disinformation campaign that was being run, then they should have a responsibility to act against that known threat.
That's right. And they could help tip the other way, right? So by and large, let's say I'm going to use the FBI as an example. The FBI has fewer agents than Facebook has content moderators. So just think of that on scale. If you could, if you know what to detect and you have that many sensors out there, you know, around the world, you could detect very quickly, and that could help triage and really use a very limited number of investigators. And vice versa, if the government was more specific about what they're, you know, actually worried about, well, then look, if you can tip that to the social media companies, you now have 10,000 more signals that you can pick up on. We've done this to a degree in cyberspace with cybersecurity, you know, here in the US and particularly in the UK is very strong at it. But we've not really cracked that egg in social media. And the barrier really has been the banter and sort of argumentation back and forth between Republicans and Democrats in Congress. And I'm hoping that can be resolved, because I think it would have been 2.5 years ago at the Alliance for Securing Democracy, which is part of the German Marshall Fund. I talked about how you could build a nonprofit social media fusion center, which has the government reps and has all of the social media platforms with their reps, which they already have co-located. So they could quickly adjudicate these things. They could quickly maneuver on it and also assess free speech. You know, they could have lawyers there that are advocates for, hey, this is clearly protected free speech. You could do a lot of that very quickly just by integrating it in a way that we routinely thought about it in a counterterrorism sort of perspective.
No, and that sounds, I think, like a really, you know, a really sensible and strategic way forward for dealing with this problem. But do you think, well, on the government side, that when we've thought about, you know, cybersecurity, cyber threats, we've principally in the past thought about protecting critical infrastructure from cyber attack, rather than recognizing that actually social media in particular was, you know, was open to being weaponized and in some ways was being weaponized by some foreign states, and that constituted a threat just as much as a cyber attack is a threat.
Yeah, General Hayden, who used to lead the NSA and the CIA, he does a remarkable discussion about how in the very early days of cyberspace, they made a decision to partition information and the technical cyber infrastructure, you know, to a degree, in terms of signals, intelligence, and how they would think about these things, and how that has had just this very long tail of frustration that is what we see today, right? Like no one has responsibility for defending American reality is a way to think about it. No one has that as their mission set. And so it's kind of fallen through all the cracks of government. It has fallen to the platforms, this distortion is occurring on their platforms. And we haven't cracked that yet. And my fear is that as we move into 2021 and beyond, we'll try and take a similar failed approach, which is this sort of whole of government or distributed, you know, way of tackling problems where no one's really in charge. I'm hoping instead that we'll take more of a task force approach where we really put some clear things in place that we want to achieve. And there's some smart folks going into the, you know, new administration who've really concentrated on this. And I hope they kind of take a lead in it. And I think the Senate and House committees, you know, have a lot of great staffers that understand this problem much better now than they did in 2015. You know, I think 2015 was the first time, or 2014, I briefed like the staff on extremism and social media. And that was the forerunner to briefing them on Russia and extremism. And they know so much more now, you know, they're so much better equipped with it, that I'm hoping they can forge that forward a little bit better in the coming months.
So it sounds like to sort of paraphrase Donald Rumsfeld, that we've moved into the realm of known knowns now, do you think, where we've got a pretty good idea of what it is we've got to do, we just got to do it?
Yeah, and it will also take moving it out of the political context. The brilliance of the Russian disinfo attack on the US and the UK and these is it ultimately came down to helping one side over another. And we don't like to really say that, you know, out in public when you listen to politicians talk. Hey, Donald Trump's a little more overt about it, right? He'll say, oh, hey, who, if the Russians help me, who cares, right? Like, that's kind of his approach. He almost reaches out for it. But for the rest, it's put them in this weird spot where, you know, if they argue one way or another, it looks like they're either taking the benefit of foreign interference or, you know, maybe denying it, and they just get kind of tied up. This is why I don't like disinformation, but I like that we're having a discussion around vaccines, which is all of society, right, is affected by this. 5G, all of society is. There's no real political side to it. I can't imagine why either political party wouldn't want to have vaccine rollout go well at this point. Let's get out of the pandemic, or let's advance our 5G so that we can be as strong as China, right? And these other things. I'm hoping when we move it out of that political lens, we'll have more cooperation at the political level, which will set the tone from here on out.
I think that's right. And as we said earlier on, I think the fact that these are clear threats, you know, the threat to the rollout of the coronavirus vaccine, but from people not taking it, is a clear wider threat to society. And regardless of your political beliefs, it's something I think most people could unify on. Hopefully that will give us a chance of making some more progress this year. I mean, just as a final note before we wrap up, I mean, are you hopeful that the new administration will make some positive steps in this space?
Well, they can't make any worse mistakes than what's going on right now, which is just nothing, right? It's just been kind of this vacuum. And I can tell you, both from Silicon Valley and from the DC, you know, government sort of side, they are ready to move forward. I feel like there's consensus and that something needs to be done. And the only thing, the dam in the river, was Donald Trump, whether it was foreign interference or domestic extremism, whether it was getting to some solutions around social media, it literally just came down to the president and you couldn't even talk about it. And if you did move, you would be destroyed. Chris Krebs, the DHS CISA head, you know, who was fired for doing an excellent job of rebutting the president on his conspiracies. That will now be gone. And I think there'll be a lot more room for Republicans who felt hostage to President Trump to start to speak more clearly. I think you saw that actually last Wednesday night. And I do think ultimately for those that are continuing on this sort of extreme populist bend in the road, they will ultimately be a little bit lost, I think, in the coming years in terms of both the social media discussion, big tech, how we want to defend our elections, or how do we want to defend Americans.
Clint, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast. It's been great to have you.
Thanks for having me, Damien.
You've been listening to the Infotagem podcast, hosted by me, Damien Collins, featuring Clint Watts and Charles Creel. It was produced by Lucy and David Dargahi. You can find out more about Infotagem, the independent COVID-19 fact-checking service recommended by Ofcom, and send us examples of disinformation you've seen by visiting our website, infotagem.com, or using hashtag IsolateTheLies on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can also support this show by becoming a Patreon at patreon.com/InfotagemPodcast. Infotagem is a not-for-profit organization, and all the proceeds will go towards the making of this podcast. Thank you. Until next time.